Accession number 20262, Real 2.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Say when?
Yeah, fine.
At the time, we were stationed appropriately at Ram in East Lothian, the airfield which had given its name to the historic DREM system of airfield lighting for night flying. The lights consisted of paraffin flares which looked like a 2-gallon teapot with a wick in the spout and produced a flickering smoky yellow flame about as dim as the proverbial Tok-H lamp which they so closely resembled and from which period I suspect they dated. They were set out at about 25-yard intervals to mark the line of the grass runway, with a crossbar to show where you should have landed and a double flare to tell you that you had gone too fast. I had briefly experienced this primitive arrangement flying Miles Masters at Advanced Flying Training School and was not impressed. With a Spitfire, it was clearly to be a different proposition altogether. The required sequence of dusk takeoffs and landings were no problem. Spitfires had no landing lights, but I could see the ground. But my first Spitfire takeoff in total darkness could well have been my last. I did not realize it at the time. In fact, I thought it had gone rather well, and the landing was far better than I had dared to hope. Imagine my surprise, therefore, when, having taxied in without hitting anything, I was told to report immediately to the CO, a distinguished French Air Force fighter pilot. "And what's the hell, Baxter?" he said. "Do you think you are doing? You have us all under the table in flying control." I was flabbergasted. It took me some time to realize what had happened, and when I did, I was too embarrassed to explain. When I'd eased the throttle forward for takeoff, I remember being impressed by the violet flames from the exhaust stubs of the Merlin. In daylight, I'd never seen them before. But as the power increased and the tail came up, an intermittent stream of yellow sparks added to the fireworks display. These I had wrongly assumed to be the gooseneck paraffin flares of the DREM system flashing past as I accelerated. Consequently, following the sparks from my own exhaust stubs, I had swung right. Spitfires tended to swing on takeoff. I cleared the flying control tower by inches, and I remember wondering for a millisecond why it was there. Those who witnessed it, the CO in particular, reasonably assumed that on my first night takeoff in a Spitfire, I had executed a split-ass turn off the deck in order to beat up flying control. Blatant irresponsibility. Show-off. There is not much one can do in such circumstances. I was lucky and I never made that mistake again. There were then, and still are, those less fortunate. A few months later, I volunteered for an overseas posting, went to the North African campaign, joined 93 Squadron, and predicated the future pattern of my whole life. That's the end of that quote. My logbook has reminded me that I flew with 93 Squadron for 9 months. That surprised me. In retrospect, it seems like at least a couple of years, for so much was crammed into that comparatively short space of time. To be precise, the North African campaign, Malta, Sicily, Salerno, Naples, and I ended up in hospital back in Algiers where I'd started. So how fared my love affair with the Spitfire during that tumultuous period? Well, by now, like a good marriage, ours was an affectionate working relationship, which was just as well because it was called upon to survive a trauma or two. For example, it was almost always either too hot or too cold, and on long sorties over Sicily from Malta or covering the invasion at Salerno from Sicily with 90-gallon long-range tanks, the cockpit of a Spitfire did not provide the most comfortable accommodation ever devised. And I remember, of course, specific incidents. My first smell of Africa when I arrived at La Senya near Oran from Gibraltar in a torrential downpour, in which two of the section which I was leading pranged on landing, an unhappy conclusion to a ferry flight intended to bring replacement aircraft and pilots to the frontline squadrons already in action. But next day I flew on to Maison Blanche, just outside Algiers, then on to Sétif, and within a couple of weeks joined 93 Squadron at a place called Souk El Kemis, which was about 90 miles from nowhere. The boss of 93 Squadron was a truly great CO. His name was Wilfie Sizer. He was a pre-war regular, had boxed for the Royal Air Force, had got a DFC in the Battle of Britain, and almost from the moment that we first met and he welcomed me to the squadron, he commanded my unqualified respect, admiration, and affection. I'd have followed that man anywhere, and indeed I did, because after a couple of sorties, he made me his regular number two. He was simply an amazing character. When the Germans broke through the American flank and began to pour through the pass of Kasperine, he led us off in appalling crosswind gale after Group had left him the option to abort the intention. It was a long way out of our normal sector and in awful weather, but he found that narrow pass through high and forbidding mountains, and we shot the hell out of him, got back, and only lost one aircraft on landing. Another time, when we were visited by a group of American press, he chased the readiness section to their aircraft wielding a baseball bat. "Sorry about that," he said to his stupefied audience. "Bit of a morale problem, I'm afraid." He saved my life at least twice, and I loved him dearly. But I'm supposed to talk more about Spitfires than those with whom I flew them. The difficulty is that they are inseparable, and if I twice owed my life to Wilfie Sizer, I certainly owed it on more than one occasion to my Spitfire. Once was in Malta, when, returning from a Sicilian sortie, I could get only one undercarriage legged down and locked, and then I couldn't get it back up again. Flying control suggested I should fly out over Birtsibuja Bay and bail out, but I did not want to lose the aircraft, and I had seen too many bailouts go wrong, and I was confident, knowing my spit, that I could land on one leg. I did so, with only minor damage to the wingtip and prop, and none to my confidence in the aeroplane. Another time came when I was shot down by American ground fire at Salerno, and had to crash land from 1,000 feet in difficult terrain, at about 130 miles an hour when I hit the ground, wheels up, of course. The Americans, by the way, were the only people actually to succeed in shooting me down, although quite a lot of others tried to do so, not infrequently. Shortly after that, I developed malaria and jaundice and was flown home with other casualties and a liberator from Algiers to Lanham. It took 10 hours, during which I did my best to care for a young soldier who had been blinded. Then, as I have said earlier, came a wonderful 6 months on rest, flying as an instructor at Montford Bridge in Shropshire. That was followed by a posting to number 602, City of Glasgow Squadron, in France, 5 weeks after D-Day. And here again I was incredibly lucky with my CO. He was the late, great Max Sutherland. I think he was the most dangerous man I ever met, and I adored him. I wasn't his number two, although we did occasional sorties together when only a pair was required. He made me his senior flight commander, and right at the end, I took over from him. After Arnhem, during which we got knocked about quite badly on the ground, the squadron was withdrawn to Coltishall, re-equipped with clip-wing Spitfire 16s, and told we now had to teach ourselves how to be dive bombers. Our principal task was to respond to the mounting threat of Hitler's V2 offensive, and so Holland became our hunting ground. We dive-bombed, skip-bombed, patrolled and strafed, bus bridges, cut railway lines, and generally did our best to make life as difficult as possible for the opposition. One of our ploys was to drop delayed action bombs, which would explode at varying times up to 6 hours after our departure, just to keep the pot boiling, as it were. And of course, the ubiquitous Spitfire again proved its merits as a fighting aeroplane. On one occasion, when we were skip-bombing a railway embankment at about 20 feet, one of my supposed 11-second delayed action bombs exploded on impact. The little aeroplane practically stood on its nose, but again, we got away with it. Another time, Maxie had the crazy idea of attacking at low level the Shell Max building slap in the middle of The Hague. Intelligence had reported it as the technical headquarters of the V1 and V2 staff. He calculated that 5 Spitfires in close formation abreast would match the length of the building, with potentially pretty devastating consequences. So off we went with £1,000 of bombs apiece, plus, of course, our 2 20-millimeter cannon and 4.5 machine guns, and a diversionary attack nearby by our friends of 453, the Australian squadron, with whom we shared the Coltishall satellites of Ludham and Matlask. And it worked, except that Maxie pulled up after we'd cleared the target in order to look back at the results, and damn near got his tail shot off. He got a bar to his DFC for that. We ran a shuttle service, take off from base, attack the predetermined target, patrol, land, rearm and refuel at a place near Ghent, then do it all again on the way back. And we did that day after day, and sometimes even twice. The only thing that ever stopped us was the weather, and we pushed those limits pretty hard. The code words for deteriorating meteorological factors were, "The door is closing." That must have really baffled the German listening. That must have really baffled the German listening service. On one occasion, when the WAF voice conveyed the message from sector control, Maxie replied, "Thank you, darling. If you ask me, some bastard slammed it in our faces." We landed on Fido, the lines of flaming petrol on either side of the runway at Manston. In addition, we flew Jim Crow shipping reconnaissance to places like Den Helder and provided escorts to both American and RAF heavy bombers to targets such as Wacheren, Heligoland and Peenemünde. We covered the liberation of the Channel Islands and flew our last stop the day before VE Day. And then, 11 days later, the ultimate bolt from the blue. 602 Squadron was disbanded, and they even sent girls to take our aeroplanes away. They were, of course, the courageous and wonderful ladies of the ATA, like Lettice Curtis and Anne Welsh, both of whom later became friends of mine, but by that time we were too drunk even to notice. Within a month I was off to Cairo to convert onto Mustangs and later Dakotas. But that was the end of my official love affair with R.J. Mitchell's brainchild, although by incredible good fortune and with a little help from our friends, we have been able to indulge in one or two flirtations together since that unforgettable and immortal period of our romance.